When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased to have with me today Dr. Pamela Robertson-Wojcik, who's written a really interesting book published by the University of California Press titled Unhomed: Cycles of Mobility and Placelessness in American Cinema, which examines homelessness, people being unhomed, and the shifting attitudes towards it, the ambivalent attitudes towards it in American politics, obviously in American film, and really helps us understand the complications and the nuance of this, that it's not at all sort of one way of portrayal or one way of discussing. So Pam, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast to take us through it.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Well, I'm very excited to have you. Could I ask you please to introduce yourself a little bit to start us off and explain why you wrote this book?
Okay. So my name is Pam Wojcik, and I'm a professor at the University of Notre Dame in the Department of Film, Television, and Theater. I've been there, 26 years. And this is my fifth book, I think. This book, I sort of stumbled into backwards. I started by noticing a number of recent films who had characters who were constantly in motion but not going anywhere. These kind of exhausting films like the Safdie brothers film Good Time, Alison Anders' film American Honey, Sean Baker's films Tangerine and The Florida Project, and then Gimme the Loot and Tramps, which are both by Adam Leone, Last Black Man in San Francisco, and a few others. And at the time, I was co-editing a book with Paula Massoud and Angel Matos that became the volume Media Crossroads, Intersections of Space and Identity in Screen Cultures. And I was trying to figure out what essay I wanted to write for the book. So I thought, well, maybe I'll write about these. And at the same time, I got invited to do a lecture at a conference in Liverpool that was about youth and mobility. So I thought, perfect, I'll develop the talk for that. And as I started working on the talk and sort of researching mobility and thinking about different kinds of mobility, social mobility, geographic mobility, and thinking about this idea of what I came to call kind of hypermobility or perpetual motion in these recent films, I linked it to a condition of precarity and the gig economy and a kind of social stagnation. And at the end of the talk, I sort of gestured backwards toward earlier films about youth and mobility, partly to differentiate these, but I also connected it to the figure of the tramp. So when I started thinking about what my next book might be, I returned to this idea of the tramp and mobility, and then sort of started thinking, okay, well, the tramp is really important early on in film history. And then I have this later thing, what's happening in between? So I started looking at different forms of mobility that had bunches of films about them, you know, to sort of work from the films rather than just sort of bring in ideas, you know, about what might exist. So that the original essay about the contemporary films became the epilogue. So the book starts with tramps and then moves through these other historical moments. In some way, this book connects to work I've done before on the apartment plot, Because I was thinking there about a different model of home, a home centered on kind of community and visibility, density, contact, porousness, against ideas of the home as private, stable, family-based. It also connects to my work in Fantasies of Neglect, which is about the urban child and particularly about the urban child being mobile. And those are ones where the child appears to be neglected and kind of unmoored, unsupervised, unprotected. But then there's a more benign sense of neglect that points to how exciting that freedom and independence and movement is. So this new project was thinking about alternatives to the dominant image of home, as the apartment plot did, and then different ideas of mobility, but thinking about them in relation to being unhomed, mobile, and placeless.
Hmm. Thank you for that introduction, and especially how it builds on your earlier work. I think that's so interesting, kind of how projects often come from things that we didn't necessarily expect. And then it's like, hang on a second, now I'm in this moment. Wait, now I'm thinking about this.
Right.
So kind of picking up on that idea of coming into the book backwards, can you walk us through how examining what you call in the book, quote, the ambivalent and shifting attitude towards placelessness, how does using that lens give us a new way to look at American film and film history?
Well, that's a really good question. I think we tend to think that Hollywood promulgates a vision of the American dream, that their ideas of home and success and social mobility and happy endings, we think of it as being, you know, escapist, superficial, glitter, sort of presenting a sort of idealized version often. But thinking about these films, and I should say, there's a lot of films in the book. The quantity, each chapter discusses a lot of films. The Tramp chapter alone, I probably talk about dozens of films there, but one of the things I discovered researching it was that between 1895 and 1945, there's over 700 films with tramps or hobos as central characters, if you look at sort of the American Film Institute catalog. And if you take out Chaplin and his little tramp, which is what most people think of when they think of the tramp, you know, Chaplin's got about a dozen features, 50 short films. So there's still over 600 films about tramps. And then the World War II chapter also has dozens and dozens of films. So there's a lot, right? And looking at this and looking at the plethora of films about different kinds of mobile and placeless figures, it becomes clear that there's sort of genres of precarity that have been central to American cinema and to the American story all along. This doesn't mean that the films themselves don't often have happy endings, and they might also be escapist comedies, but they're pointing to a different vision of America, a different way of being, either as an alternative, a mode of resistance, or as failure, that reminds us that that American dream isn't always available to all. It's not easy to access, and sometimes it's not even desirable. So these narratives point to home and fixity in America, but always sort of hinge on othering certain modes of mobility and promulgating others. So there's a tension between viewing homelessness as, on the one hand, deviance or threat, and on the other as freedom and independence. So the films, I think, reveal discourses and changing ideals in America regarding the status of home, and about poverty and class and social mobility. And I think they provide an access point to think about what it means to be domiciled, who can choose to be unhomed, how mobility is defined through privilege and precarity. And these are questions that, you know, really came to the fore during the pandemic, which was sort of happening across the time I was writing this. So it felt very alive to me in that way.
Yeah, especially given that timing. Particularly given that you mentioned sort of shifting attitudes and changes over time, I want to make sure we know exactly what it is that we're talking about so we can continue to have the discussion. So can you sort of pause for a moment on definitions and tell us what you mean by unhomed, mobility, placelessness, and cycles?
Sure. That's a really good question. And I, in the intro, I really mapped this out because I want to be careful because I think all of these terms have multiple meanings. So people might have certain expectations, and, you know, I'm talking about it in a slightly different way. So, okay, unhomed. This is a key term. And in part, this echoes Homi Bhabha's famous formulation of the unhomely as a kind of paradigmatic post-colonial experience that relates to the experience of migrants and others for whom geographic or cultural dislocations are defining traits. Bhabha's unhomely correlates with being physically unhomed, moved, right, with a sense of what the geographer Edward Rolfe talks about as existential outsideness, where one resides in a location but experiences feelings of alienation and not belonging, right, tied to particularly that kind of post-colonial experience. In some places, that's what I'm talking about, particularly when I talk about World War II and the experience of returning veterans. But I'm more interested in the condition of being unhomed prior to or instead of finding a new location, more in the space between homes than sort of that uncanny feeling of home, more in the journey or the movement than the destination. So my sense of being unhomed is always related to the idea of home, where home is a problem and not always a goal, where one can be willingly unhomed or unhome oneself in an act of resistance or rejection. And it's a little different from being homeless or unhoused, though it encompasses those, because in some ways it is about that affective experience, that feeling of being unmoored, uprooted, mobile rather than anchored. So when I'm talking about unhomed, you know, it can mean different forms of mobility and away from home, right? So it can mean kind of a constant experience of being mobile like a tramp, or a hitchhiker, right? And it can also encompass being homeless and what I think we tend to think of now, which is sort of living on the street, right? So it encompasses a number of different modes. The next word, mobility, Tim Creswell has written extensively about this. And mobility can mean a wide range of things, right? It can refer to very simple bodily movement, large-scale geographic movement, social mobility. It can include modes of travel, such as walking, train travel, cars. It can be viewed as a positive force, again, related to ideas of adventure, freedom, privilege, tourism, or successful migration. But it can also be viewed negatively, you know, because it's seen as sort of counter to stability, counter to rootedness, and it can seem shiftless or transient, right? So in the book, I'm trying to think about complicated reactions to mobility and different forms of mobility. So I'm not really talking about physical mobility, right? In the sense of whether someone can physically walk. I'm thinking about walking, train travel, public transit, hitchhiking, and then different scales of mobility. In some chapters, I'm looking at characters who are traveling across the country or overseas, and in some, I'm thinking about small circuits of movement within a city or a neighborhood. So thinking about the tramps movement on foot and by rail, the governmental movement of troops by train during World War II, young women hitchhiking across the country, the wanderings of houseless people in urban centers, and then in that last chapter, the kind of constant movement of workers in a gig economy, and all of it in relation to ideas of social mobility. And I'm also thinking about it through a consideration of the aesthetics of mobility as, you know, central to cinema. So things like tracking shots, the contingency of an encounter, transient spaces of mobility. So thinking about those spaces like train stations, hobo camps, sidewalks. So it's getting at a lot of different angles on mobility and different modes of mobility. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it definitely makes sense.
Okay.
And it's very helpful to have clarified.
And then the last two, Placelessness and Cycles. So again, placelessness can mean many things. Geographers often use it to talk about the erasure of local specificity, you know, the idea that all places start to look alike because they all have the same chain stores, right? That there's a sort of loss of specificity in the local. That's not particularly how I'm addressing it. Placelessness also connects to mobility and that sense of being less anchored, being transient, being not confined to a place, and also as having no place in society. So a lot of what I talk about in the book are characters who are viewed as marginal, viewed as disposable or unworthy. You know, this idea comes up strongly in the way the homeless were viewed in the 80s, where there was a lot of discourse about them being trash or waste, out of place on city streets in a gentrifying city. And then I also think about the sort of marginal in relation to the tramp and the hitchhiker who, you know, garner a lot of attention, but are always seen as somehow outside or counter to the dominant. And that sense of placelessness and that sense of moving through transient spaces and of not being sort of stuck in a place, but also not having that stability of place. And then cycles, this is different because this is sort of thinking about film, right? And Amanda Klein has written about film cycles really in smart, terrific ways. And film cycles are differentiated from genres because they're usually short-term market-driven clusters of films. Sometimes they might then turn into a genre. You know, this is what happens with film noir, where people are making what they perceive as thrillers or crime movies. And then the French say, oh, we'll call it film noir. And then people think of film noir as a genre and now it continues, right? But often it's something like, you know, copycat films that aim to capitalize on a trend. So, you know, a whole bunch of films about tornadoes or sharks or something, zombies. But the cycles, the way I'm thinking about film cycles is this idea that they capitalize on a kind of moral panic, right? Some kind of moment when the culture is thinking about experiencing some kind of problem and trying to figure it out, right? And there's people sort of trying to gin up negative feelings about it, but there can be all these mixes of feelings, right? With this kind of cultural anxiety. And it could be something like immigration or nuclear war. In the case of the films I discuss, it's these different kinds of mobile figures, right? So thinking about cycles that emerge out of a panic, you know, so the hitchhiker becomes a figure of concern first in the post-war period, where there's this perception because the FBI is trying to clamp down on hitchhiking. So there's this perception of sort of sociopaths on the road, right? And then later in the late 60s, early 70s, the panic about hitchhiking shifts to be very gendered about young women being on the road and what that means in terms of their leaving home, their sexuality, women's liberation, a lot of different things, right? So each chapter is organized around a different cycle of films, and some of them are quite short. You know, the hitchhiker, the girl hitchhiker, is just a couple of years. The tramp, I stretch the cycle to cover basically 1895 to about 1945, because there's different waves of panic and there's changing views about the tramp. And the tramp really is dominant in that period and then very abruptly stops being present. So while these film cycles operate sort of during a panic, while the issue or the concern is alive, they don't project a sort of simple, clear message, right? They don't just sort of deal with negative concern, but they represent a wide range of responses. So they're kind of working through a moral panic, teasing often a fascination with the figure at the same time as a worry, right? So they're very contradictory often in terms of how they're treating these figures. So that's how I'm thinking about the cycles and kind of moving through those.
And as you said, that's very much how the chapters are organized as well. You mentioned two of the chapters there. Do you just want to briefly mention what the other chapter's cycle focus is?
Sure. So as I said, each chapter deals with a different cycle of films. Each one produces a different kind of discourse. So it's not just different figures, but each one is taken up very differently, which was part of what interested me. I ended up organizing each chapter around a word that in some way captured an aspect of the dominant discourse around the figure. And each chapter deals with different kinds of films, so that the film cycles vary in terms of style and market. So the first chapter is the one on the tramp, and that's called Ubiquitous. So that's the word, the tramp's mobile masculinity. It hangs on the word ubiquitous because the tramp is an inescapable and intrusive presence, not only in the cultural imaginary, but in the world. There's a real sense that you can't kind of swing a cat or cool a pie, more accurately, without a tramp wandering by. And this is what differentiates tramps from previous vagrants, the sense that they can reach into rural areas as well as urban, and that they're crisscrossing the country, right? Because the train makes it possible for them to sort of traverse these broad areas, and then they can walk and move, so that, you know, there's a sense that you can't be anywhere where there's not tramps. And tramp films are in certain ways as ubiquitous and pervasive as tramps themselves. And they traverse multiple genres. They include musicals, silent shorts that are generally comedic, silent feature films that are sometimes comedic, sometimes melodramatic, sound films that extend into the Depression when the tramp becomes a very sympathetic figure. There's social problem films, romantic comedies. You know, they range quite broadly in terms of what kinds of narratives about the tramps, but the tramp is sort of this coherent figure and that idea of ubiquity at the same time that he's marginal, right? And so it's a really interesting thing to think about his adjacency to the dominant culture. And I say he because there's a few things organized around girls who are tramps, but it's predominantly a male character. The second chapter deals with a kind of wholesale crisis in domesticity that was engendered by World War II that impacted not only servicemen and women who were uprooted from home, but also civilians who moved to be near defense plants and bases, and then a years-long housing crisis that followed. That chapter, I hang it on the word uncivilized, and it's about World War II mobilization and homecoming as a social problem. So it's dealing with a tension between a return to civilian life for soldiers and a real fear that they've become uncivilized while in the service. And this produced a moral panic about what got called the veteran problem. There were myriad books, articles, all this kind of attention, and it started before the war ended, right? That there was this real concern, what are we going to do when these guys come home? Because the temporary unhoming of soldiers, the movement of soldiers and civilians alike were seen to be life-changing because citizens were sort of liberated from conventions associated with civilized life, unmoored from the norms of society, particularly related to things like sex, marriage, and race relations. So even though I'm dealing here with some comedies and musicals and melodrama, I put them all under the broad category of social problem films, because they're all sort of trying to figure out that issue of how to bring the soldiers home. And this is something that, because it was ultimately so successful, I think we forget how difficult this moment was and what it meant on the ground. The third chapter I mentioned deals with hitchhiking, and that chapter is called Adrift, The Freedom of the Female Hitchhiker. So it talks about the film noir hitchhiker and a lot of the history of hitchhiking and some, you know, little hitchhiking moments in the 30s. But the bulk of it is about this kind of early 70s cycle of films about runaway women. And it's Adrift in the sense of wandering and being perceived as sexually loose, because it's this kind of voluntary countercultural precarity and mobility that seems to threaten ideals of home and family and also challenges conceptions of youth and women. And those films are mainly in the realm of exploitation. They're very titillating. They're kind of not porn, but they're definitely drive-in movies to a large degree. The next chapter looks at the beginning of modern homelessness in the 1980s. And that chapter is called Trash, The Homeless as Urban Waste. And these are films that emerged right when the new category of homeless was just emerging. And there really was a moral panic that denigrated the unhoused as a kind of scourge, you know, on the gentrifying city. A lot of the same terms that we hear now. And the films are interesting because on the one hand, they demonize the homeless as trash or urban waste that needs to be eradicated. So there are horror films that, you know, sort of treat the homeless as a kind of grotesque spectacle. And then on the other, there's films that sort of fetishize homeless men, particularly as having transformative and even magical powers, right? Things like The Fisher King. And in these films, the unhoused are often paired with a yuppie, and they're kind of these interesting representatives of urban life in the context of gentrification, kind of pitted against each other, but then these films show some kind of yearning on the part of the yuppie for the authenticity that the homeless bring, and to sort of assuage their guilt about their own wealth. So these films in this chapter are largely middle-brow social problem films on the one hand, and then weirdly, what I think have to be characterized as bromances, that emphasize a kind of free market capitalism and trickle-down economics in these narratives of sort of private benevolence and individual transformation, right? Where the yuppie can help lift up the one homeless person. And then the epilogue, as I mentioned, is the chapter about the precariat that I started with, and it's called Stuck, Perpetual Motion, and As Slow Death, because the characters are constantly moving but going nowhere, so they're kind of stuck. And these are films that have been characterized as neo-neorealism. I talk about them as slow death cinema using Lauren Berlant's idea of slow death, where she describes the physical wearing out of a population, the deterioration of people in a population that's very nearly a defining condition of their experience and their historical existence. So thinking about that kind of physical wearing out, the physical mobility, this unending circuit of movement, and the lack of social mobility altogether. So kind of moving through each of those, picking up different aspects.
Yeah, no, exactly. Thank you for giving us that kind of roadmap, I suppose, of the book. It very much, I think, identifies each cycle, but also shows the links between them. So I'd like to ask about a bunch of them in a bit more detail now that we have the kind of big picture. Mm-hmm. You've mentioned the tramp in a few different ways, which I think is really interesting. I wonder if I could ask you to talk about an aspect of it we haven't discussed as much so far. You have this great quote in the book that the figure of the tramp in early cinema, quote, unspools the range and variety of possibilities for modern masculinity, which is, I admit, not necessarily something I had thought that much about in terms of the figure of the tramp. Could we discuss this aspect?
Yeah, the tramp is really fascinating. The tramp is an insanely popular character, right? Not only in films, but there's comics about tramps, there's songs about tramps, there's tons of autobiographies of tramps. There's tons of sort of social analysis of tramps. There's all this activity. Vaudeville is riddled with tramp figures, right? So I think Charlie Musser says he's the most popular character in turn of the century entertainment, right? And the tramp emerges at a key moment, you know, when sort of modernity is coming in. And in some ways, the figure of the tramp, this idea that there's a sort of new form of vagrancy, right, is tied to aspects of modernity like the railroad. It's also tied to the Civil War because men learned how to kind of tramp around, forage for things, you know, use the railway, use all these different things. But it's also this moment when modernity, with all of its sort of technological achievement, with the, you know, changing urban landscape, is challenging a lot of assumed precepts, right? And it really is a sort of important moment for thinking about masculinity. Michael Kimmel, who's sort of a historian of masculinity, talks about how prior to industrialization, right, manhood meant something like autonomy and self-control, right? But as you get sort of industrialization and all of this, fewer men own their own shops or control their own labor. They're more economically dependent. They're more subject to the regime of sort of the time clock, right? So this feels like a moment that is potentially emasculating for men, right? It's a real sea change in how work is perceived, right? And the tramp doesn't fit paradigms of sort of dominant masculinity that would be associated with modernity, right? He's not participating in this work culture, but at the same time, he doesn't suffer that kind of grind or that sense of emasculation, right? And in some ways, the tramp fails, right? He's not achieving proper stability. He's not achieving domesticity. He's not a breadwinner. But he also can be seen as challenging the sort of assumption that these forms of work, these forms of marriage, these forms of reproduction and breadwinning, that they're defining, right? So he's kind of an oppositional figure, and he's taken up, you know, the Wobblies take up the figure of the tramp as a kind of key figure. So it's an interesting thing where on the one hand, even though he doesn't work, he's perceived in a way as part of the working class. And he, you know, sort of offers this alternative model, a kind of counter-hegemonic image that privileges unemployment over employment, begging or stealing over earning, being single over being married, mobility over home, and unfettered sexuality over reproduction, right? But he's also pretty interesting because in some ways he operates very similarly to dominant masculinity in that he subordinates others, right? Sort of the white tramp is predominantly a native-born man. And there's ways that tramps and tramp films kind of mock immigrants and non-whites and also mocks feminized elites, right? And so kind of takes down sort of the upper class. But more than anything, he kind of invades the spaces of women and kind of asserts control over feminine spaces. So he's sort of operating in multiple ways in relation to conventional masculinity, but kind of taking in certain ways the privileges of a certain form of masculinity with none of the responsibilities. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And I think the idea that it's kind of playing into some expectations but not others does exactly this complicating work that you've been discussing with the tramp throughout.
Yeah. And he, you know, he shifts over time so that he becomes increasingly sympathetic as you get toward the Depression, you know, because at that level, everybody's available to be a tramp, right? And so he's not quite the same as sort of Dust Bowl migrants, but he can affiliate more with that and seem more a victim than someone who's wholly resistant, you know, or lazy or, you know, these other things. And so it shifts over time. But there's definitely ways in which the tramp seems to be someone who can come in and authenticate masculinity and in certain instances teach other men sort of a model of authenticity. You know, so there's a movie, Father Steps Out, where this guy who's this rich but, you know, emasculated, like he's weakened, he's on all this medicine, he has to go on a trip, you know, to sort of deal with ulcers and heart issues and all this. And he falls off the train and falls in with these two tramps. and sort of through that discovers his masculinity again, right? Including, you know, at a basic level, he can smoke cigarettes and eat spicy food again, and then he can fight back against the people who have tried to take over his company, right? And, you know, that kind of thing is kind of interesting in the way that, you know, he can kind of interaction with the tramp remasculinizes him. Right. And so he has this interesting relationship to other men as well.
Yeah, no, that's definitely interesting to pull out. So thank you for adding that in. I wonder if we can turn to the next chapter of the book and pick up on the thread you mentioned earlier that kind of because of how well it turned out, we forget how anxious everyone was about kind of what's going to happen at the end of World War II. So can you take us back to that? What were how was this anxiety coming up in film? How was this being negotiated in film?
Yeah, and it's not, you know, it's not only film, right? Throughout the book, I'm thinking about sort of the larger historical discourse that's happening around these films and that the films are participating in, right? They're not just reflecting, but they're in conversation. So as I said, even before the war ended, there's tons of articles and books about the veteran problem. One of these is this guy, Willard Walter Waller, who writes The Veteran Problem. Another one, this guy, Dixon Wechter, writes Johnny Comes Marching Home. And they assume that all men will have difficulty adjusting to civilian life, whether or not they've seen action, whether or not they're visibly wounded or psychologically distressed. That just inherently, by virtue of being uprooted, it's going to be a problem for these guys to come back. And, you know, we do think of post-World War II as this glorious time. You know, it's the greatest generation. And we get all these stabilizing influences, the expansion of employment, widespread college education, home ownership, you know, the stereotypical mid-century kind of cult of domesticity. But it only happens because the war first unhomes millions of men and women, and as a result, produces this wholesale crisis in domesticity. You know, in terms of the numbers, there's over 11 million draftees, more than 6 million volunteers serving in various branches of the service. I think 73 or 75% of those go overseas, right? Then you have 350,000 women serving in the WACs, the WAVES, the Air Service pilots, the Coast Guard, the Marine Reserves, right? 6,000 women employed by the Red Cross, USO. And then you have 15 million male and female civilians who move to find jobs in wartime industrial production or to be near military bases, you know, female camp followers who trail their husbands. So it's a massive uprooting. And, you know, I think for decades it was perceived as one of the largest, right? We've outpaced it with some recent things, but it's a mass mobilization. So there's all this anxiety about sexual promiscuity among both sexes, teen sex, sex with prostitutes, VD. There's also a concern about quickie marriages and a rise in divorce related to that. The rise of single and unmarried mothers, fears about women's mobility and liberation through wartime work, and then housing shortages that compromise, you know, conventional kind of opportunities and boundaries for privacy. And these housing shortages are happening in these places where there's the industrial bases, you know, where industrial production's happening during the war. And then when the men come back, there's a huge housing crisis. And there's this feeling that people have been outside the regular restrictions of, in some way, conventional morals, right? And taken for granted ideas about class and race, as well as gender, and sort of hierarchies and privileges. So, you know, there's a number of films that deal explicitly with the return, you know, Best Years of Our Lives, most famously, Till the End of Time is another one. But then there's also films about the housing crisis, you know, sort of the more the merrier, you know, where people can't find apartments. Rosie the Riveter is about the housing crisis. But I also look at a number of things that deal with, you know, men on leave and the kind of sexual promiscuity that occurs there. And quickie marriages, things like The Clock, things that deal with men who do experience some kind of physical or mental wound, right? So things like Pride of the Marines or Bright Victory or The Men, where you have men experiencing blindness, you know, paraplegics, and sort of trying to come back. But also, you know, films that are dealing with sort of the psychological crisis. So it encompasses a lot of different ways of negotiating this. And there's a very explicit sense that these films are participating in this and these magazine articles and all of this. And there, a lot of them are very much directed at women, because the idea is that women are the ones who are going to have to fix this, that they're going to have to fix the men. And at the same time, there's an idea that women have been uprooted themselves and had new privileges and capabilities in the world and have been living on their own or working and doing these things or having different kinds of sex, and that they're going to have to be kind of put back in place. So the films are kind of dealing with it in a lot of different ways. And a lot of it, as I say, is comedic. A lot of it is sort of melodramatic, and very, there's a lot that are sort of tugging on your heart sleeves, you know, to kind of make you feel how difficult this is. So it's a pretty expansive response. And as I said, there's dozens and dozens and dozens of films. I mean, just the ones about the housing crisis, you know, there's easily a couple dozen of those, you know, and some of them are very small movies and some of them are bigger.
No, but the scale of it or the quantity of it kind of tells us something in and of itself. And it's just really interesting to kind of go back to this moment, given, of course, how it turns out. And especially now building on those two chapters, talking about the tramp and masculinity, talking about the concerns after World War II and everyone coming home. And as you said, it being very much kind of towards the woman to fix things. That really sets up the next chapter, focusing on young female hitchhikers. That's really quite a departure in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
That's like a whole new way of thinking about all of this. So can you talk us through what's going on here in the 60s and 70s?
Yeah, I think the hitchhiking chapter is almost certainly the most surprising. You know, it's not at all what you think of if you look at this book and you think homelessness, most people aren't going to think hitchhiking. But as I started thinking about the book, and as I said, I wanted very much to work from the films up, right? I think there's a way that sometimes we approach a topic and we sort of project an idea onto films, right? And so we'll sort of say, well, I'm looking at homelessness, therefore it's going to be about, you know, sort of poverty and, you know, a kind of failure or victimhood or something like that, right? We don't normally think about something like hitchhiking, but as I was thinking about, well, what are films doing and how, what do they teach us? What do they show us? And the hitchhiker became a really interesting figure to me, because in some ways this is a figure who, while sometimes hitchhiking is just a mode of travel, right? It just gets you from point A to point B, but these films in particular emphasize hitchhiking as a lifestyle. And they come out of a very particular moment. So hitchhiking, very popular. As soon as there's car culture, there's hitchhiking, right? And in the 20s, it's fun, it's youthful, it's men, it's women, it's children. In the 30s, it becomes something that, you know, ties into the Depression. So hitchhiking is part of a sort of community of care. Right. In the 40s, initially, hitchhiking is viewed as a patriotic act, right? Because you're saving tires and gas, and there's a real sense of people coming together, right? So Emily Post writes an article about hitchhiking etiquette for women hitchhiking to those wartime plants, right? With all these ideas about how to make it safe and pleasant and do this properly. So it's a very acceptable practice. And it, in the 50s, it shifts a bit because the development of the freeway system, it's suddenly much harder, right, to hitchhike because these big roads and ramps aren't as friendly as sort of the smaller roads. The FBI gets on it and starts to worry a lot about crime and murder, which, you know, there had been incidents with hitchhiking, but no more than in any other sphere of life, right? But the FBI gins up this kind of concern. So it gets demonized mid-century, but it bounces back very quickly. And it bounces back as it becomes associated, particularly with youth and youth culture. So in the 60s, you know, there's a very strong sense of young college students hitchhiking. And these are people who, it's not because they don't have money. It's partly anti-car, but it's much more about a new mode of travel that's also tied to the development of new travel guides. You know, Let's Go, which is written by, I think it's Harvard students. There's an idea of travel attached to youth. It also becomes linked to the Beats, right? And Kerouac sort of inspires this generation. So there's this real sense, and there's all of these hitchhiking guides that come out in the 60s into the 70s that are aimed at youth, that view hitchhiking not just as a convenience, but as a kind of generational countercultural activity, right? And the female hitchhiker emerges through this, but it's also tied to running away. And running away also shifts. So in the, you know, 50s, 60s, kids run away, but it's usually perceived as sort of a boy running away to go, you know, see a circus or something. He's heading to something. But then there's this real increase in the number of runaways and an increase especially in the number of girls running away. And it's perceived not as a harmless activity where they sort of run away to the circus, but as something where they're running away from home. Right. And it's a rejection of home. And it becomes framed as a large scale social problem. So Congress in 1974 enacts the Runaway Youth Act, where they're recognizing that there's a standalone population of runaway children who deserve policy intervention. Right. And there's also this concern because, you know, during the Summer of Love, people are traveling to San Francisco, they're moving, and there's this sense like, oh my gosh, we can't tell the hippies from the kids anymore, right? And this real sense that runaway children are being absorbed into hippie culture. So as there's more emphasis on girls leaving and staying away from home and a kind of burgeoning sense of girls, there's this anxiety about girls and an anxiety particularly about these runaway girls hitchhiking because it gets tied to a kind of perceived loosening of morals, tied to kind of hippie counterculture. And also hitchhiking, this is the period when kind of the slogan for hitchhiking is gas, ass, or grass. And those are the three ways you can pay for your ride, right? So these films show girls running away from home, often from oppressive parents or because they've been impregnated by an uncaring boyfriend, and they go on the road and they meet up with other hitchhikers, and it becomes a sort of lifestyle. And as I said, they're all kind of exploitation pics. So they show these women kind of engaging in some cases, orgies, in other cases, having threats of rape on the road. Whenever they're picked up, there's a sort of taken for granted assumption that the guy is going to try to make some kind of move, whether it's violent or offering money. And it's treated as completely taken for granted, right? So there's one, Clint Eastwood directs this movie Breezy, where this girl is in a truck and, you know, the guy tries to attack her. And she just kind of jumps out of the car and goes like, oh, another day for Miss Dum-Dum. You know, it's completely taken for granted. But what interests me about these films is they don't fit any conception of normal kind of what we would imagine the women's lib movie would be, right? These are exploitation films, but there's a sense that they point to dissatisfaction. They point to women not wanting to follow in their mother's footsteps, that they're trying to imagine a different life, that they want freedom, that they're rebelling. And there's ways that that becomes very interesting. And I think that's as much the threat as their sexuality. So they are unhomed and they are unmoored from home. And there's no sense that they're heading to a new home, right? They are just on the road. And that's where they want to live. And that's where they want to stay. And that's why I thought it was a really important and useful chapter to have in the book, because I really do want to think about sort of these different forms of mobility and different ways of being unhomed. And in this case, sort of as a kind of countercultural movement, I think it's really interesting and really essential.
Absolutely. And I've already kind of highlighted the contrast to it with the previous cycles that you've discussed. It also very much contrasts with the next cycle in a lot of ways, right? Thinking through those things about choice and about lifestyle really kind of put into contrast the type of homelessness that you document in the book kind of starts from the 1980s and is still much more the kind of homelessness I think we have today. And excavating the different cycles in the book helps us remember that what we have now isn't what has always been, right? It kind of came up at a particular time and place and had particular reactions. So can we move to the films in that sort of long 1980s and how they're reacting to what might seem much more familiar kinds of homelessness?
Yeah. And what I, you know, this chapter in some ways, I will say, was the most painful to write. Partly because going back into that history and seeing all of the governmental decisions that produce this homelessness, right? You know, sort of ways that social services were diminished, ways that, you know, in doing urban renewal, you know, you sort of get rid of SROs, you get rid of skid rows, you get rid of these places where sort of placeless people had a place to be, right? That they had these opportunities to live very minimally, but they had some kind of location they could return to that had services, that had barbers, that had these things. And as you get gentrification, as you get, you know, sort of this emphasis on certain modes of wealth and this kind of disregard for other people, and it becomes increasingly difficult for people to afford rent, let alone buy a home, and to access any kind of governmental help, you know, you get this increase in homelessness, you get this diversification of who's homeless, you know, it's more families, it's more minorities. But the reaction is very interesting because on the one hand, you get sort of some social problem films that look at homelessness, you know, Lee Grant directs both a documentary and a TV movie about homelessness. And you get a number of these, and they tend to focus on white families, particularly white women. You know, that's sort of the new face of homelessness. And they're very earnest, but they don't critique sort of the larger system, right? They look at these individuals and they either are sort of like, oh, that's terrible, and they kind of throw in a statistic at the end that says a lot of people are homeless, or, you know, there's some kind of magical thing. So there's a TV movie, Stone Pillow, with Lucille Ball, who emerges directly out of a garbage bag, and the emphasis on trash, you know, I tie it to Reagan talking about sort of waste in the budget, but also people talking about homeless people as waste, as trash. When Amtrak decides to get rid of all the lockers in the train station so that homeless people can't come in and wash up, they say, isn't there a way to get rid of this trash, right? And they produce this kind of disgust about the homeless, you know, at the same time that they're refusing to allow them to have a way to wash themselves. So all these kind of crazy contradictions. But so, you know, Stone Pillow will have Lucy suddenly at the end, somebody gives her a cottage and she's fixed, but it doesn't address the larger problem. So that's one tendency. Then there's some low budget exploitative kind of horror films, Chud, Prince of Darkness, Street Trash, that treat homelessness as just the abject, right? It's just horrific. The majority of the films that I'm looking at, though, are these kind of middle-brow comedies with, you know, what people talk about Q ratings, right, for sort of well-known, likable, well-regarded stars and directors. So, you know, Eddie Murphy and Dan Aykroyd and John Landis's Trading Places, Richard Dreyfuss, Bette Midler, and Nick Nolte in Paul Mazursky's Down and Out in Beverly Hills, Jeff Bridges and Robin Williams and Terry Gilliam's Fisher King, Jim Belushi and Kelly Lynch in the John Hughes film Curly Sue, Mel Brooks in his film Life Stinks. There's a number of these. And, you know, they have homeless characters in these kind of individual narratives of redemption and even romance that in some way, you know, by focusing on one individual person who gets lifted up often through these kind of bromances with a yuppie, they kind of dodge the darker truths of homelessness. So they're working through it and trying to, in certain ways, create sympathy, but at the same time, not really questioning the status quo, right? And that chapter, I actually start it with Crystal Waters' song, you know, with the video for this, which is the la-da-dee-la-da-da, la-da-dee-la-da-da, and she's homeless, you know, and this kind of facile idea about homelessness that I think is really worrying in the period. And treats homelessness as largely comedic fodder. So, and I think that a lot of the ideas about trash and disgust, you know, the films are riddled with images of garbage, eating garbage, people wearing trash bags, people living in dumps, things like this, traveling on garbage cans, but also that larger sense of sort of treating a whole community as trash, which I think continues very strongly today.
Speaking of continuing, you mentioned right at the beginning that the book has an epilogue and that you kind of worked from the modern backwards. I'd like to talk about that and especially the idea that the book has an epilogue. It doesn't have a conclusion. Why not?
Yeah. I think because the story of precarity is not over. Homelessness is obviously a huge problem. We're still grappling with how to treat people who are mobile and placeless. I mean, questions about, I live in Chicago, and currently there's large questions about what to do because the Texas governor keeps putting migrants, many from Venezuela, onto buses and just sending them to Chicago where they have no contacts, no place to live. Just, you know, thousands and thousands of people dumped into a city and then, you know, other kinds of homeless in the city and questions about, you know, how can we serve this community if we're not serving this community? What do we do? The Supreme Court is currently hearing a case where I think it's in Oregon. They want to make it illegal to sleep outside, even though there are no shelters in the town where these people are sleeping outside. And so they want to fine them and say, you can't do this, but there's nowhere for them to go, you know, and sort of this lack of care. And one of the things that interests me is that problem of homelessness, even though it's dominant, and if you go to California, if you walk around Los Angeles, it is a huge problem there. There are huge populations of people living on the street, but the films have largely turned away from that, you know, and I think we've gone to kind of fantasies of superheroes or dystopic imaginations when in some way the dystopia is right here. And, you know, we're projecting this thing into the future. And so I felt that a conclusion would imply something was finished. But I think this is ongoing. And the book actually, I think the last word of the book might be revolution, because at the end, in thinking about contemporary precarity and the gig economy and the lack of social mobility, you know, I started thinking about a different definition of mobility, sort of the historical definition that is sort of the mob, the rabble, the common people, the working class, right? And thinking of that sense of the mob and trying to think how to sort of convert mobility into something more like a revolution and a real change. So I didn't think it was over, and I hope it's not. And I hope that thinking about the different ways that we've sort of projected these ideas onto people who are mobile and placeless and, you know, often demonize them, you know, can help us think about what we're doing now and how we're demonizing contemporary migrants and contemporary unhoused people.
Is that one of the big things you want readers to take away from the book?
I think so. I mean, I think, you know, I want people to think about this longer history, to think about how, you know, we do treat people who are unhomed and placeless as often lesser. And I think that, you know, a kind of ethics of care is vitally important. And I think that, you know, we have all of these people now, and we have to really rethink. And lots of people are doing amazing work and amazing rethinking. I teach at the University of Notre Dame, and locally, there's a really good housing first movement that has been putting people in motels and really helping them move forward into permanent housing. And, you know, a lot of people are doing amazing work on the ground, but I think the overall discourse is still so dismissive. And I think, you know, just to sort of reexamine our history, to be aware, this isn't anything new. There have been, you know, these other populations, and to sort of think about the ways that we've talked about them, treated them, forgotten them, you know, I think is helpful.
Mm. I think there's rather a lot to think about there, which is very helpful. But before I let you go, can I ask, obviously this work, as you suggested at the beginning, very much builds off of the books you've previously done. Mm-hmm. Has this book sparked a next project? Is there anything you might be working on now that this one is complete that you'd like to preview or highlight?
I'm not, you know, those books were all in some way about space, right? And thinking about cinema and space. More recently, I've been thinking about grief, and thinking about a sort of spate of grief-centric media. I'm thinking about podcasts like, you know, Mark Maron's podcast, or Anderson Cooper has a podcast all about losing his mother. And a number of TV shows like The Bear or Somebody Somewhere or WandaVision, movies, you know, that there's a lot of things about grief. And it feels to me like it's a little bit different from the way that grief has always been a narrative catalyst, you know, to sort of set in motion either, you know, a revenge narrative in something like Hamlet, or, you know, a romance in something like Love Actually, or these different things. But these texts seem to me to be about grief itself as a problem of not knowing how to grieve. And part of that, I think, is that many of us, you know, because we're not attached to religious organizations in the way we used to be, are unsure how to mourn. So I think there's a sort of loss of some of those rituals. And then I think it's also that there's some sense of a larger cultural grief, you know, which is sort of tied to obviously the pandemic. But I think also the climate here in the States, I think democracy, a lot of us are just sort of wondering what happened to that. Women's rights, trans rights, you know, that there's this sort of broader sense of loss. And so I'm trying to think about that, but I don't know that I want to inhabit grief for the length of a book. So I'm trying to decide if that's, maybe that's an essay.
Fair enough.
You know, so that's where I've been thinking recently.
Well, those sound like very interesting thoughts, and I'm sure in whatever form they take, it will be fascinating to read. But of course, in the meantime, listeners can read the book we've been discussing, titled Unhomed: Cycles of Mobility and Placelessness in American Cinema, published by the University of California Press. Pam, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you so much. This was fun.